Well, I want you to go ahead and take your Bible tonight and open it to the book of Romans, chapter 16. And I just want you to leave it there. I promise you, I'm going to get to the text in a moment. But I want to talk to you tonight about the principle that changes everything. Tonight, I want to tell you a very simple principle that if you practice it as an individual, it's going to change how people relate to you. If you own a business, if you practice this principle, it is going to have a positive effect on your business. And in the context I'm going to share it tonight, as you practice this principle as a church, I promise you, people will be driving from miles around to be a part of your church. Now, I realize that with what I've just said, I have set a very high standard for that principle. But I believe by the time we conclude tonight, you're going to agree that it is a principle that changes everything. But tonight, before I tell you the principle or we get even to our text, let me take you on a journey of how I discovered the principle I'm going to share with you tonight. My grandmother, my father's mother, lived to be 93 years of age. She had a wonderful mind. She cared for herself. She taught Sunday school until she was 90. And my grandmother always said she wanted to live to be 102. And one day I went to see her and I said, "Big Mother, why do you want to be 102? She said, "Well, I'd like to live to be 100 to say I did it, and then I'd like to have 2 years to brag about it." And I said, "Well, that makes sense." But my grandmother, as she got older, she developed this habit of saying something, and you knew what she meant, but it wasn't what she said. Now, have you ever talked to somebody like that? You clearly know what they meant, but it wasn't what they said. I've written down a little notebook. I have so many examples of these, so let me just give you two or three of them of my grandmother, because you'll catch the spirit of my grandmother tonight. The little church where my grandmother attended in a little rural place in Alabama, their preacher became very ill, and the people just could not understand why a wonderful, godly man at such a young age would be really struggling physically with this disease. And so he called me one day, and he said, "Phil, I need to ask you, would you be willing to come and speak to our church on suffering and how God uses suffering in our life?" And I said, "Sure, I will." So on a Sunday evening, I went to my grandmother's little church, and I remember when I got there, I spoke on suffering and how God uses it in our life. And at the conclusion of the service, my grandmother walked up to me very sincerely, took me by the hand, and said, "Son, I want you to know I did not know what suffering was until I heard you preach tonight." I know what she meant, but it wasn't what she said. I give you another one. Every time someone heard me preach and reported it to my grandmother, she called me. She called to tell me what they said, whether it was good or bad. And one day she called me and she said, "Son, did you speak?" And she told me the church this past Sunday, and I said, "Yes, ma'am, I did." She said, "Well, I need to tell you that my friend Hazel was there, and she said for me to tell you that the last guest preacher they had preached for 1 hour and said absolutely nothing, but you did it in 30 minutes. I think I know what she meant, but it wasn't what she said. Let me give you one more, and please understand the spirit in which I share this, because not only I am no way making light of something that is very serious, and I don't want you to take it that way, and I even share this with permission and encouragement of the family, because they love the sweetness behind it. But my grandmother had a friend whose husband had developed some serious dementia, even Alzheimer's, and that's a very serious disease, and I am no way making light of that. But as he kind of advanced and his mind began to deteriorate, he had always loved going to church. And so his wife every day got him into the routine that after they ate breakfast, he would sit in his recliner, and she had a CD player, and she put in CDs of preachers, and he would sit there and listen to them all day, and he enjoyed that. And one day my grandmother called me, and she said, "Oh, I got news for you." I said, "What is it?" She said, "Grace called and told me to tell you that you have become her husband's favorite preacher since he lost his mind." Now, I know what she meant, but it wasn't what she said. My grandmother had this unusual perspective of things, too. I went to see her one day, and when I did, I went to her house, and I could just tell when I got there that she was just a little blue. She wasn't feeling well. And I said, "Big Mother, you okay?" She said, "Oh, I'm fine." She said, "I've just been a little discouraged lately." And I said, "Well, why? Why would you be discouraged?" She said, "Well, son, I've just been thinking. You know everybody that went to school with me is dead?" And she said, "I got to thinking," my grandmother came from a big family, she said, "everybody in my family except one sister's dead, all my brothers and sisters." She said, "You know everybody at our church my age is dead. And that's just a little depressing." And I said, "Well, Big Mother, I think it's wonderful. I mean, you've lived a good life, and you're still here." And my grandmother, and her name was Lenny. That's an important part of the story, by the way. My grandmother looked at me, and she said, "No, it's terrible." And I said, "Why is it terrible?" She said, "Because they're all sitting around heaven saying, 'I don't think Lenny's coming. I don't think Lenny's coming.'" My grandmother. But my grandmother had also developed one other characteristic. As she got older, my grandmother got into this routine, especially when she was in her 90s. She would get up every morning, and she had four or five friends about her age that she would call just to see how they were doing. Then she would eat lunch, and then in the afternoon, she called those same four or five friends, and they continued their conversation. Then she would eat supper, and before she went to bed, she called those same four or five friends. Now, that was my grandmother's routine every day. Now, there was one problem. If you were not one of those four or five people she called two, three, sometimes four times a day, when she called you, she had a tendency to start the conversation in the middle of a conversation. My grandmother would call, and you had no idea what she's talking about, because she just assumed that you was, you know, privileged to all of those earlier conversations. So I was sitting one day in Atlanta Airport about to get on a plane to leave, and my phone rang, and it was my grandmother. Now, normally I called her, so it was a bit rare for her to call me. So I answered it, and I said, "Hello, Big Mother." And without any words of introduction, without her saying, "Son, where are you? Where you going? Where you been?" Without any words of introduction, with a rather desperate voice, my grandmother, when I said, "Hello, Big Mother," she said, "Son, what's wrong with Obadiah?" So I thought somebody in our family named Obadiah is sick. So I went through the family as quick as I could. Obadiah, couldn't think of anybody by that name. So I decided, well, I didn't want to show my ignorance to my grandmother, so I would rephrase the question. And I said, "Well, Big Mother," and kind of throw it back to her, I said, "Well, is he sick?" She said, "No, he's dead." I said, "Well, that's probably what's wrong with him if you think about it." She said, "Son, he's been dead for years." I said, "Big Mother, we need to start this conversation over. You call me and you ask me what's wrong with Obadiah. Now you tell me he's been dead for years." Then my grandmother explained her question. You see, my grandmother had a Bible that she got during World War II when Franklin Delano Roosevelt was president. I don't know what that had to do with my grandmother's Bible, but every time that you mentioned her Bible, she would tell you she got it during World War II when Franklin Delano Roosevelt was president. And my grandmother had done something a lot of people do. My grandmother, every time she heard a preacher preach, she would take a pen and she would write in the margin of the Bible the name of the preacher and the date, and she would draw a little line to the text. Now, my grandmother had done that since she got that Bible in World War II when Franklin Delano Roosevelt was president. And that morning, my grandmother had gotten up and she was doing her morning devotion. She had a little devotional book called Open Windows. Some of you may have seen that. And it would have a text and she would read it and then she would read what the devotional said. Well, that particular morning, my grandmother's text was from the Old Testament book of Obadiah. And she had read it and she had read the devotional and then she looked back and she realized that in that Bible that she had since World War II, when Franklin Delano Roosevelt was president, all the margin was clear. She had not heard one sermon from Obadiah. And she began to wonder why. She thought, well, I'll call my preacher grandson and ask him, son, what's wrong with Obadiah? That's why she called me. Well, after that, I went to see my grandmother, and I asked her, I said, Big Mother, can I look at your Bible? And I picked up my grandmother's Bible that she had had since World War II, when you know who was president. And I sat there and looked at my grandmother's Bible, and do you know there were books of the Bible, like Obadiah and Nahum, where my grandmother had never heard a sermon? And there were sections of books in the Bible, like Leviticus and Job, where my grandmother had never heard a sermon. And there were chapters in the Bible where my grandmother had never heard a sermon. And one of the places my grandmother had never heard a sermon was Romans chapter 16. And after looking at her Bible, I decided that I was going to go back and visit some of those scriptures that we as preachers had ignored. And I went back to Romans 16, and as I was reading it, all of a sudden this principle emerged, the principle that changes everything. Now, probably the reason you have not heard or you've heard few sermons from Romans 16 is because all Paul does in this chapter is send greetings to friends. He just says, basically, say hello to that friend for me. That's all he does. So preachers tend to ignore that as just concluding remarks to the book of Romans. But I want to show you tonight some of the things Paul said and show you how it unfolds this principle. Look in verse 3 of Romans 16. Paul said, "Greet Priscilla and Aquila, my fellow workers in Christ Jesus, who risk their necks for my life, to whom not only I give thanks, but all the churches of the Gentiles give thanks as well." Notice verse 6. "Greet Mary, who has worked hard for you. Greet Andronicus and Juno, my kinsmen and my fellow prisoners. They are well known to the apostles, and they were in Christ before me." Notice verse 12. "Greet those workers in the Lord, Tryphena and Tryphosa." I just love those names. Probably were twin sisters. Verse 13 says, "And greet Rufus, chosen in the Lord, also his mother, who has been a mother to me as well." Now I want to ask you tonight, do you believe that the early Christians loved the Apostle Paul? You cannot read the New Testament without realizing how much people loved Paul. You remember in the book of Acts when Paul is on his final missionary journey and he goes to the church at Ephesus, and when he concludes his time there, the leaders and the elders of the church go with him down to the ship as he is about to depart. And when he gets to the ship, they pray together, and then Paul tells them they would see his face no more, and they fell on his neck and wept. Now, you don't weep when someone's leaving unless you love that person. People loved Paul. But do you know the reason why people loved Paul? It's because Paul loved people. Here's the principle that changes everything. People love people that love people. Would you say that out loud with me? people love people that love people. Now, if I ask you tonight, do you love people? Every sane person in this room would say yes. If we went around the room, nobody would stand up tonight and say, I'd just like to say I hate everybody. Now, if you did, you wouldn't be here tonight. You would tell me you love people. If I ask you, as a church, do you love people? You would say, yes, we love people. So the problem for us is not do we love people. The issue for us is do we know how to express our love and make people feel loved? And in Romans 16, Paul demonstrates how to make people feel loved. Three little simple things he does that you can do, and when you do, it changes everything. Paul knew first that love appreciates people. It appreciates people for who they are, not for what they can do for you. You know, when I first read Romans 16, and I was noting all of the people Paul mentions, and knowing that when Paul wrote Romans, he had not been to Rome. He went later, but at the time, he had never been to Rome. I thought, I know what Paul's doing here. He's greeting all of these people because these are probably, you know, church leaders and civic leaders, maybe wealthy people. These are all people who can help his ministry. So I said, if I researched all of these people, and there's 27 people that Paul mentions by name in this chapter, if I research all of those people, I'm going to find they are people of influence that can help Paul. So when I made the list and researched it, to my surprise, over half the people Paul mentions are either women or slaves. Now, do you realize in Roman culture that women and slaves had no legal standing at all? So for you to understand how women and slaves were viewed in Roman culture, it would be like how Americans view dogs and cats. They have no legal standing at all. Or to put it another way, they could do nothing to Paul, nor could they do anything for Paul. You know, if you want to know the test of love, the test is how do you treat people who can do nothing for you or to you? I have a dear friend named Maury Scobie. Maury Scobie has devoted his life to doing one thing. He was the personal aide and assistant to Dr. Billy Graham. Now, almost all of you in here tonight know who Billy Graham was. He was probably the greatest preacher in terms of the crowds that heard him preach of anyone in recent history. He recently died at 99 years of age. Dr. Graham would preach in large arenas and stadiums around the country, and people would come to hear him preach. But he also, especially in his latter years, became very influential in international affairs and with presidents and world leaders. And one day, Maury and I were talking. Maury was the guy who made sure his suitcase and his luggage got on the plane and he had what he needed. That was Maury's life. And he did that even up to Dr. Graham passed away, caring for him and while she was living Mrs. Graham. And I said, I want to ask you something, Maury. You know Billy Graham as well as any human alive. Is there any characteristic of Billy Graham you did not find in other people? And he said, oh, absolutely. I said, what is it? He said, Billy Graham appreciated everybody. He said the man was consumed with telling people thank you. He said when we traveled, you could not get him to the seat on the plane because he had to thank the flight attendants and the pilot and tell them thank you. You could not get him to a room at a hotel because he had to thank the maids for cleaning the room. Everywhere he went, even when we did the crusades, he had to tell the people in the crusade, the first responders and the ushers, thank you. The man was consumed with telling people thank you. So it's no surprise that the Billy Graham Library in Charlotte, North Carolina, if you go there and you research it, over 75% of the people Billy Graham wrote in his lifetime was to tell somebody thank you. Now I wonder,
Do you think Billy Graham had the impact he did on presidents and world leaders because they saw in him a man who did not have a personal agenda but wanted to love people for who they were? Let me tell you, you start appreciating people that rarely hear a thank you. You start loving people for who they are, not for what they can do for you. And believe me, it changes everything. You know, even in church life, if we admit it, sometimes when people come to our church, we have a tendency. Now, this is just between us girls here tonight. We won't tell it outside this room, all right? But let's be honest. When people come to our church and maybe they come in and you could just tell they don't have a lot of money and maybe they're poor, do we react the same way from someone who maybe pulls up in an extremely expensive car, who has nice clothes? Do we react the same way? Let me tell you what I've discovered. When a church loves people that nobody wants, they end up getting the people everybody wants. Because you see, even the wealthy know, do you want me because of who I am, or do you want what I can do for you? And love always says, I love you for who you are, not for what you can do for me. But Paul said, wait, there's more. Paul also said, love acknowledges people. You see, if I'd been writing Romans 16, you know how it would have read? It would have been one verse, and it would have said, tell all my friends hello, period. I wouldn't have listed everyone's name. And I would have been writing with a modern computer. Paul is writing with primitive writing instruments, probably some that had been thrown away by other people. And so as he's sitting there writing, one archaeologist said, it may have taken him or his scribe as long as 1 minute to write one letter of the Greek alphabet. Now that meant it took him nearly 30 minutes to write Tryphena and Tryphosa's name. You know why he did? Because love always acknowledges people. Let me ask you a question. Have you ever talked to somebody who maybe they moved to a new area, maybe someone in your family or friends, and they're starting to look around for a new church home? So they're visiting different churches. And so maybe they say, well, you know, we went to this one church and we really did not like that church. So you ask them, what was it about that church that you disliked? Do you know the number one thing you will hear? I went to that church and nobody spoke to me. But have you ever wondered why that offends people? I mean, think about it. In your life, you've never heard anybody say, I got thrown in jail the other night, but I'm never going back because nobody spoke to me. Or I had to go to the hospital when I had a heart attack the other night, and I'm not going back because nobody spoke to me. But why is it when people come to church and nobody speaks to them, it offends them? I'll tell you. Because do you realize people subconsciously know when you don't acknowledge their presence, you're really saying you're not that important? Because when people are important to you, you will always acknowledge their presence. In fact, let me give you that from the business world. You go read the early days of Sam Walton, who started Walmart. And Sam Walton acknowledged in the early days he could not compete on price. So he discovered he could do one simple thing that set him apart from everybody else. And I don't think they do this now, but in the early days they did. At the front door, he put a Walmart greeter. And you know what he discovered? When people came into the store and someone was greeting them, and many times by name, it changed the whole complexity of his building. That's why when people come to church, we must acknowledge them. And by the way, the Bible is clear. There are two ways we're to do that. One, Paul does it here. John said in 3 John 14 that we are to greet the brethren by name. We're to call each other by name. I mean, there's something. You see, we would all say Jesus is the sweetest name we know. But the second sweetest name you know is your name. And people love to hear their name. And when you call people by their name, it validates them and makes them feel loved. In fact, do you know my friends who are in politics, especially at a federal level, when they begin to train candidates, one of the things they teach them is everybody you meet say their name at least three times. Robert, it's good to see you. Great being with you, Robert. Robert, you have a good day. Studies prove that if a politician does that, the odds that person will vote for them tripled. Now, if it's true in politics, shouldn't it be true at church that we call people by name? Now, I know what somebody's going to say at the close of the service. They always do. Well, preacher, I agree with you, but I'm just not good with names. To which I always ask those people, if that's true, where do you find the incredible ability to remember the name of everybody who owes you money? You ever thought about it? There's a guy here in San Antonio. He owes me $5,000, and for the life of me, I can't remember his name. No, you never hear anybody say that. Now, I know what people mean when they make that comment, but can I tell you something I've learned from experience? People appreciate the effort even if you get it wrong, when you're sincere, but it validates them when you call their name. But wait, I said there's two ways. The other one is in verse 16. Did you read it in Romans 16? You can read it for yourself. Paul said, greet each other with a holy kiss. I'm just preaching what the Bible says. You mean when we see people, we're to run up to them and kiss them? No. Let me help you. In Roman culture, that was the proper way to greet someone. In American culture, the equivalent is shaking someone's hand or hugging their neck. When you see somebody and you say, man, Sam, it is good to see you, and you hug their neck. Mary, it is good to see you, and you hug their neck. You know how they feel? They feel loved. You know one thing you know, and everybody else does too, you know when somebody's glad to see you. And you know when they are, how it makes you feel. But then Paul said, love also affirms people. See, Paul just didn't in Romans 16 say, here's a list of everybody and say hello to them. No. Notice what Paul did in those verses I read a moment ago. Paul said, say hello to Priscilla and Aquila. They once risked their life for me. Priscilla and Aquila knew that. You know what Paul was doing? He was bragging on Priscilla and Aquila to the church in Rome. And he said, say hello for that lady, you know, in your church, Mary. Why, she's one of the hardest working people. He said, say hello to Junia and Andronicus. Do you know they are known among the apostles? And they came to Jesus before I did. And say hello to those precious ladies for me who do so much, Tryphena and Tryphosa. And then he said, and say hello to Rufus and his mother. Did you read what Paul said? She has been like my own mother. That's literally what he said. Now listen to me. You know what Paul is doing? He's bragging on those people to the church in Rome. That's what he's doing. Let me tell you something I've learned. When you love someone, you naturally brag on them. You see, when you love someone, you have filters on, and you look through those filters, and it causes you to see the good and not the bad. I give you an example. We mentioned to you this morning that Debbie and I have three grandchildren. Our two granddaughters are totally different. One loves to play soccer and the other loves dance. Well, I can tell you, and our grandson is 16 months old and he's starting to do all those things that you do for the first time. And you know what I found myself doing, especially with our six-year-olds? I found myself saying to people things like, you know, now I'm not saying this because she's my granddaughter, but Zoe really is the best kid on the soccer team. And I would say, you know, I'm not saying it because she's my granddaughter, but you know, Emery really is the best dancer up there because she loves dance. And I'm not saying it because he's my grandson, but Bryce is probably the smartest kid I've ever met. You know what I'm thinking, right? I'm really saying that. Why? Because they're my grandkids. So now I got convicted about that, so I just dropped that part. Now I just say Zoe is the best one on the team. She is the best dancer. I don't even like the part about grandkids. But you know what I discovered? The reason I said that is because I got a filter on. I don't see all the time she causes them to lose the game, or my daughter falls down, or my grandson is outperformed by someone else. No, I don't see those. You know why? Because I'm not looking for it. What I'm looking for is the good. And you know, when you love somebody, when you're looking for the good and you find it and you brag on a person and it's sincere, you know what that person does? It makes them feel loved. Mark Twain said, you can live on a good compliment for 6 months. And he's right. And when you love people, when you really love people, you appreciate them for who they are, not for what they can do for you. You always take time to acknowledge them, and you make them feel valued, and you always take time to brag on them. And you know what's really good? You brag on them when they're not around, and the word gets back to them. Boy, do they really feel valuable. I want to tell you a story. True story about a 5-year-old boy. His dad's a pastor friend. This young boy is now older, but at the time he was 5 when this occurred. From the time he was 4 years of age, for some reason known only to God, he became fascinated with the garbage man. Every week he would get out of bed early so he could eat his cereal, and he would stand on the front porch and watch the garbage man come. And when he got the garbage, he would just wave, and somebody had told him the garbage man's name was Bill. And he'd say, "Hey, Mr. Bill." And he watched in awe as he got the garbage. Then he would go play. His dad said 6 days a week you couldn't get him out of bed. But boy, you could get him out of bed on the day that the garbage man came. Well, a few years ago, Christmas was coming and approaching pretty fast. And one night, the family was making out their list of gifts they needed to buy. And the little 5-year-old said, "Hey, we need to get the garbage man a present." But, well, we don't normally get the garbage man a present. "Well, I like him. I want to get him a present." So the dad, seeing it as a teachable moment, said, "Well, I tell you what, why don't you and your mom bake some cookies and we'll give them to the garbage man for Christmas?" And so that year, as Christmas was approaching, and just the Tuesday night before he was to run on Wednesday before Christmas, they baked the cookies. And the next morning, the little 5-year-old was up early, and his dad said, "Now, don't go to the street until you see him coming, and I'll go with you." "Okay." In a few minutes, he said, "Daddy, he's coming. He coming, Daddy. He coming." "All right, get the cookies." So he got the cookies, a little paper plate and cookies and a little paper towel on top. And he and his dad, the preacher dad, they walked down to the street, and the garbage man stops his truck. The garbage man gets out, and he says, "Sir, is something wrong?" My preacher friend said, "Oh, no, no, nothing's wrong. You probably noticed that my son, he's rather fascinated with the garbage truck." "Oh, yeah, he's always standing here waving." "Well, we wanted to get something for you and your family for Christmas, so he and his mom baked some cookies, and we'd like to give them to you." And the little boy handed him the cookies and said, "Merry Christmas, Mr. Bill." And then out of nowhere, the pastor said, "I don't know where this come from." He said, "Thank you for getting our garbage. It sure would stink around here if you didn't." He put the cookies in the truck. But when he turned around, the garbage man had a tear trickling down his eye. He said, "You know, sir, thank you. I don't think anybody's ever given me cookies for Christmas because I'm their garbage man." He said, "What's your line of work, sir? What do you do?" He said, "Well, I'm the pastor of a Baptist church down the road. Do you and your family attend church?" "Well, it's just me and the wife, and sorry to say we don't go to church. But we need to. We might come to your church some Sunday." And the little 5-year-old said, "Hey, this Sunday before church, my preschool choir is going to sing before church. If you come hear me preach, I'll sit with you during church." He said, "We might do that." My pastor friend said he looked up, and that Sunday morning, the garbage man and his wife came in, and just as he promised, the little 5-year-old went back to where he was sitting and sat with him during church. And when church was over with, and many people have told me this story, that little 5-year-old had the garbage man going around saying, "This is Mr. Bill, best garbage man in town right there. Never spills our garbage, best garbage man in town right there." And he took him around. Well, I have to tell you who came to church the next Sunday. And the next Sunday, and the next, and it was in January that my pastor friend received a phone call, and the garbage man asked if he could come to his house. And at his home, he said, "You know, we used to go to church, but we've never really given our life to Christ." And it was then that the garbage man and his wife gave their life to the Lord. Now, I've met that garbage man and his wife. They're actively involved in that church now. But do you know why they're involved? Because a 5-year-old got it. A 5-year-old understood the principle
that changes everything. A five-year-old understood that love appreciates people who normally aren't appreciated, takes time to acknowledge them. Hey, Mr. Bill. And it affirms them. Best garbage man in town right there. And that five-year-old brought a garbage man and his wife to the foot of the cross. It is a simple principle, but it changes everything. People love people that love people. Would you say that one more time? People love people that love people. Would you bow your heads with me, please?